Order at 5:00. This is the Special Committee on Fisheries. Present are Representative Holgan, Representative Osterman, Representative Ivan, and Representative Hutchins. Tonight, we have a presentation by the National Marine Fisheries on fishing issues of the state of Alaska that concern the state of Alaska. And today, we have Mr. Berg making a presentation. Forward, sir, introduce yourself and we'll jump right into it.
Yeah, well, thank you, members of the committee. Pleased to have this opportunity. I'm the Chief of the Fisheries Management Division with the National Marine Fisheries Service, the Alaska region. Basically, my outfit, my division manages the groundfish fisheries off Alaska. But I'll go into some detail on that. I've got a couple of handouts that I brought along with me, and because I'll be using them for reference. One is just titled An Overview of Federal Fisheries Management. Another one is called Alaska Fisheries Overview. And the second document is a show and tell that we often will bring to meetings or provide as handouts to people who are visiting our region to try to give them an overview in whatever it takes, half hour, longer, about what the federal fisheries does up in Alaska. My outline that I have on the overview of federal fisheries management, I'll use for my own notes, but I've got it organized so I can kind of jump between the two documents. And so if you'll bear with me, I'll do that. And you know, this is probably a reasonably informal group where I can probably, if you want to ask questions as we go through things, well, you know, feel free. Basically, the National Marine Fisheries Service consists of five regions and five research centers throughout the United States. And so Alaska is one, and the Alaska Regional Office is located here in Juneau, Alaska. In this glossy handout, I've got a chart about three pages in, which just summarizes our wire diagram that we have. I'm down on the lower left-hand side under Fisheries Management Division, and I report directly to our the original administrator, Stephen Pinoyer, who's in the very top box. We manage the fisheries off Alaska in close coordination with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and also with Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We have close liaison with the U.S. Coast Guard for enforcement endeavors that they perform for federal fisheries management off Alaska. Our jurisdiction goes from 300 to 200 miles under what we call the Exclusive Economic Zone. Those were established, first of all, by the United States, and then pretty much all the major industrial countries across the world has an Exclusive Economic Zone going out to 200 miles. We don't manage from the beach into 3 miles directly, although I'll talk about that a little bit more in detail. Now, that's state of Alaska waters. And our jurisdiction does not go into state of Alaska waters. Our basic mandate is the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. That act was first promulgated in 1976, first implemented on March 1, 1977. And way back in those days, the fisheries off Alaska was largely a foreign fishery operating beyond the 12 mile, I guess I'll call it an economic zone, certainly beyond 3 miles for state of Alaska management. And in those days, they used to take vast amounts of pollock and cod and flatfish and rockfish without really a lot of oversight. In order to provide for a boost and how U.S. fishermen could participate in that, Congress passed the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which gave exclusive authority to the federal government, U.S. federal government, in that exclusive economic zone. They established the councils, the fishery management councils, and I can probably say that the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is probably the lead management agency with respect to coming up with policy, new regulations, new programs, and then what the U.S. government does is we implement those. So I attend all of the council meetings that they have each year, five, and then, of course, many committee meetings during the year. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council has five fishery management plans that were authorized by the Magnuson-Stevens Act. We have two groundfish fisheries, Bering Sea groundfish, Gulf Alaska groundfish. We have a scallop fishery management plan, and also a crab fishery management plan in the Bering Sea, not in Gulf Alaska, just in Bering Sea, and also a salmon fishery management plan that largely has federal oversight and council review of state of Alaska management in its own programs. Any way you look at it, we leave it up to the state of Alaska to manage the crab and salmon and really scallop fishing off of Alaska. We have minimal review and minimal oversight of those fisheries, and we leave that up to the state of Alaska with general counsel federal oversight. But we do have a major role in, yes?
Those are just the two that Alaska has, and that's the scallops and the crab?
And salmon. Yeah. In salmon management in southeast Alaska for the troll fishery for Chinooks and for coho salmon is coordinated to a great deal by the U.S.-Canada treaty, which, as you've probably read in the papers, has had various degrees of success. That salmon plan has been largely delegated to the state of Alaska, recognizing the state of Alaska's expertise and really traditional management of salmon. It covers the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska and certainly southeast Alaska here. And of course, those fisheries up north are net fisheries largely as compared to the hook and line troll fishery down here off southeast Alaska. So when I say when we have a major role in federal fisheries management, I'm probably talking about a major role in groundfish management. And I'll get into that in a little bit more detail here. As I already said, our authority comes from Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. After you go through the first two pages of this outline, you'll get into a list that I just brought along for detail, which talks about brand new responsibilities of the North Pacific Council under the Magnuson-Stevens Act as recently implemented by the Sustainable Fisheries Act that President Clinton signed into law on October 11 of 1996. There's a lot of detail there, and I'm not going to go into that because you almost have to have a solid foundation of the Magnuson Act itself in order to understand some of the details there. If any questions arise from that, I'll talk about that. But in my outline, I did talk about three subject areas because they'll really involve the state of Alaska. One is essential fish habitat. One is an individual fishing quota fee program. And one is a central lien registry. And all three of those programs have short time fuses with respect to implementation by the federal government working with the North Pacific Council. The state of Alaska, of course, is a major player in habitat protection of Alaska. And of course, because federal fisheries, because the National Marine Fisheries Service is also a conservation agency, we have a major interest in that as well. Probably in Alaska, of course, there's pristine habitat, undeveloped habitat, but I say that relative to other ocean bodies of the United States. You know, you're probably familiar with Southern California and the Gulf of Mexico and the East Coast where development and therefore possible conservation problems being imposed on fisheries is a lot more important. But because of the Magnuson Act, and when I hold up this red book here, and if anybody ever wants copies of that, I can get you copies. This is the up-to-the-date Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act. And it's this book which provides all of the mandates that were imposed on October 11. Essential fish habitat is something where throughout the United States, but also in Alaska, we're going to assess and define essential fish habitat, and that itself has to be defined. It has a definition in here, which largely talks about habitat, which is important to the spawning, rearing, and general livelihood of any of the fish, including those that are not managed by FMPs, fishery management plans. What it's going to do is provide the authority for the North Pacific Council to set up guidelines which other agencies, as well as any other type of development activities, would have to coordinate with the National Marine Fisheries Service and provide summaries of the how their project might be implemented in federal waters and how their projects might be mitigated to reduce problems for fisheries habitat. Our role will not be a permitting agency. Our role will not be like the Corps of Engineers, which is a permitting agency where they authorize Section 10 permit reviews and actually permit projects in federal waters or in navigable waters, actually. But ours will be a much stronger role in habitat conservation, where if some type of project was not going to make sense in terms of, say, fishery conservation, then the National Marine Fisheries Service would have a greater oversight role to have such an industrial activity explain why and explain how mitigation measures might be offered up. Yes.
Your statements just now bring to mind some of the concerns that I've heard in reference to the new version of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and they've even extrapolated that back to Cook Inlet, to the Kenai River, of habitat degradation on the Kenai River that might affect the spawning abilities of salmon. Is that something that would fall within what you're talking about right now?
Yes, it would. The streams that flow into the ocean are as important marine habitat for anadromous fish stocks, salmon. And so part of that review would also include waters in Cook Inlet, feed into Cook Inlet, as well as, say, for another example, waters in Southeast Alaska relative to forest activities. So it's a major initiative on the part of my agency. We've been having public hearings throughout the United States. We conducted them recently in Anchorage, as well as Kodiak, some other cities in Alaska, in order to explain the program and how it's going to work. There's going to be a lot of interest in that program to see how it works. It's probably not funded adequately at present, and that's going to be a challenge for my agency to deal with. But with respect to what we might anticipate from the program, I think it's a strong tool for habitat conservation with respect to essential fish habitat. A couple of other items here I'll talk about. And again, there's a lot of detail with respect to the way the Magazine Act was recently implemented. And I could probably spend my entire 5 hours here tonight on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But I think that the we as legislators are going to be dealing on an ongoing basis with the issues that are explosive type issues like the Cook Inlet, the Desic River, and things like that. And what you've just said to me, has some concern on my part as to how we'll address some of those issues as well. All of a sudden, because of the rewrite of this Magnuson-Stevens Act, that the Kenai Borough, for example, is going to have a hard time in their habitat ideas along the Kenai River based upon what may be the interpretation of the federal government now as to what are essential habitats and whether the expansion of some of these areas can take place. So I think it's something that we, as you develop where you guys are going with this thing, and I understand that it's, you're still in that process. And I don't expect to get any concrete hard answers out of you tonight, but as you develop some of your ideas that are going to affect particularly the salmon industry, because it is an industry that comes ashore, we as legislators or the Fisheries Committee or the Resources Committee be kept apprised for you guys for the development that should take place, would sure be beneficial to us to know where we go as well. So.
And we have experts in my region that are actually directly involved with that program, and I'm sure I can volunteer them to come here and speak in front of you for provide more detail too. Another item which will be of interest to the state is establishment of a fee program to assess fees on individual fishing quota amounts and also on community development quota amounts. And the purpose of the fee is to promote and to pay for some of the administration of that program by the state of Alaska. The Magnuson-Stevens Act provides that upon application by the state, the secretary, meaning the Secretary of Commerce, shall allocate up to 33% of the fees collected, the ex vessel value of the fish landed, and provide it to the state in what is called a Limited Access System Administration Fund, LASAF, in order to reimburse the state for actual costs directly incurred in the management and enforcement of these programs. So the state of Alaska eventually will be receiving, through application, a return based on this this fee program. Well, in addition to that, another one which is of direct interest is a central registry for the limited access system permits, and by this I mean IFQ permits. This is a national program, but really the biggest and the most highly visible program is the existing sablefish and halibut IFQ program here in Alaska. What we are doing is to promulgate regulations which will provide a central lien registry system so that fishermen who are applying for IFQs transfers, and they need to have bank loans, for example, to do this, that banks would have a central point to go and query databases to see what if there are liens on any of those IFQs that have been allocated. So we'll be kind of like a title company. And just like title companies look at real estate liens, we'll be looking at liens on IFQs.
Can you step back to your fees that you were talking about a minute ago? You guys have not imposed a fee program yet upon the IFQs, have you?
That's correct.
But you are working on the process of doing that.
Yes.
And do you have a time frame that you know of when that might happen?
We have a milestone deadline of October of this year. Now, my sense of it is that since that date itself is not in the Magazine Act, is that we will do our best to meet our own imposed milestone. At this particular time, I wouldn't be able to say that we'll actually make that. But the program will be coming along some time, and State of Alaska, North Pacific Council staff members, members of my particular division had a meeting this Monday that they actually started to pursue how those programs might be implemented. There'll be a regulatory program, and so eventually there will be regulations promulgated for public comment and then finally implemented to make the program work.
Thank you.
There's a lot of bureaucracy in this as we proceed on some of these programs.
Because this is a very loose agenda tonight, any one of you guys that want to jump in with questions like I'm doing, just go ahead and do it. You don't have to ask permission from me.
Oh, okay. Basically, I was just wondering, I don't have your agenda here to know what your areas you're going to talk about. I have some questions about bycatch and observers and stuff, and I assume we'll be talking about that a little bit later on.
Yes, I've got those in the second sheet of the
great
of the handout.
Okay.
And what I'm going to do is try to assess how much detail I'm putting into some of these things,
right,
with the idea of also trying to answer those items. And at any time, you know, if you feel like, well, you want me to pick up on those before, you know, well, feel free, and I'll change my agenda just like that.
Well, I assume we're going to take the full 2 hours with this,
it's
or
available.
Great, great. I'll just go right with your agenda and the appropriate times. I'll ask questions. Thank you.
Well, let me just jump over real briefly then back to my hand, this glossy handout. There are some real interesting things in this. One, of course, is just the size of Alaska relative to the United States. You know, I mean, this is a big state. There's a lot of resources here, and a lot of responsibility for all resource management. You know, it goes from coast to coast. You know, I think there's one time zone now, but I think there used to be geographically five time zones. So it's a big state. The fisheries are big. The size of the exclusive economic zone is big. You turn to the map that shows the various exclusive economic zones. You can see the one for Alaska is the biggest of all. And that's why we have such a huge fishery up here, is because there's just a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus, which is coming up from the abyssal depths, coming up into shallower water, feeding zooplankton, feeding forage fish, and then finally feeding predators. And those predators include, of course, bigger fish, and finally marine mammals and seabirds. So that's a huge ecosystem. It's vast. And I think because of the exclusive economic zone that was mandated by the Magazine Seals Act back in 1976, that the United States fishermen are able to enjoy a large harvest from that. If you go to the very next page, we just talk about recent landings, and this comes from the published fisheries of the United States. For Alaska, you can see we've got an annual harvest total of seafood of 5.4 billion pounds. Billion pounds. Now, the next billion on there is the Gulf of Alaska, which is 2.2 billion. I mean, pardon me, the Gulf of Mexico, which is 2.2 billion. So right there, Alaska's is twice that. If you go to the next billion.
Can I ask you a question? If you go back to the economic zones, it looks like maybe it's misleading because it's not the scale, but it certainly looks like Alaska is probably quite a bit more than 51% of the area, and yet we're just doing 51% of the catch. Would that mean that there's a lot more potential up here in Alaska, or does that mean that they're actually better fishermen down below?
Well, actually, a lot of the of the harvest, we have an annual quota for groundfish of 2.4 million pounds, pardon me, metric tons. And a lot of the harvest is underutilized for a lot of different reasons. Markets is a major reason. If we're talking flatfish, for example, and say a flatfish like arrowtooth flounder constitutes a huge proportion of the total flatfish biomass off Alaska. Yet there's not a lot of economic opportunity to utilize it. You might have heard before where you take arrowtooth flounder and try to cook it, the muscle pretty much turns to a jellified mush. So until they can solve that type of a marketing problem to try to figure out how to take care of the flesh quality of arrowtooth flounder, there's not a lot of market for it. Another reason is is because of bycatch, which I'll get into later. We have what we call prohibitive species catch limits that actually control how much the director fishery gets to take. Halibut is one of those bycatch species. Halibut happen to live where the other flatfish live. And we stop these other federal fisheries when a particular bycatch limit is reached. So there's a regulatory response here where even though there's lots of fish yet to be caught, we're not able to catch it because they won't be allowed to because of like bycatch. And I'll talk about that in more detail later.
Then it's safe to say that we would actually, by regulation, we're kept at a level that we could probably exceed if it weren't for the regulations.
Yes, that's true.
Thank you.
Of course, what the North Pacific Council has done is not to reduce the quota to mesh with how much bycatch might be to support it. They keep the entire quota available. What that does is provide the incentive to the industry to figure out ways to reduce bycatch, where they might get them more groundfish per pound of bycatch. Mm-hmm. You see, and so there's incentive there for them to try to reduce bycatch. Just a few more pictures here, just to quantify. When we talk about the size of the U.S. continental shelf, the Alaska has 70% of the total United States exclusive economic zone. Continental shelf. We've got 47,000 miles of marine coastline. We've got 28% of the total 0 to 200 mile shallow water area. And then again, we have the 5.4 billion pounds of harvest annually. And that's groundfish, crab, shellfish, all of it. Not just groundfish. We have a total ex-vessel value of $1.4 billion. That's ex-vessel value, that's the value to the fishermen. That's not the wholesale value, it's the first order wholesale value where you might multiply this particular value here by two or three to come up with even larger value. Got a couple maps in there showing the reporting areas, which is that are important to me. That's how we manage the fishery. Again, there's more information on the individual value of the individual components. We go from a value of halibut of almost $60 million annually, all the way down to groundfish, which is almost 600 million dollars. Now again, we'll talk about the next vessel value of the groundfish fishery being 600 million, but if you multiply that times three, well, that's $1.3 billion when you finally expand this across to the first order wholesale value.
In this map you show here of the areas, the reporting areas of the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands, do you actually have people report in the donut hole?
Yeah, we have regulations that require U.S. fishermen to report fish that they catch from the donut hole. and we associated with their federal fishing permit. If a vessel decides never to get a federal fishing permit, then we don't have a tie into their reporting. But
how accurate do you think you are with the reporting in that specific area? Is there?
We believe it's accurate.
With the foreign vessels?
Well, with foreign vessels, we're not sure. Now, for U.S. vessels fishing out there, we believe it's accurate. Now, there are bilateral or multilateral agreements between the United States and other countries, including Russia and China, Poland, other vessels that fish in the donut hole. And a lot of this has to do with their own interests in terms of, say, conservation, to try to make that management of the donut hole work. The donut hole is something that has had vast upswings in terms of, say, annual harvest. It's depressed right now. There's been no fishing in the donut hole now for about, I believe, around 4 years. In order to allow those stocks to try to rebuild. But because those nations also have an interest in those stocks coming back because they'll extract revenue from it, they have an interest in the accurate reporting because eventually, if it were to be opened up, it would be to a multilateral agreement. And if the United States is reporting accurately and there's a sense of confidence in that by these other nations, then we're anticipating that those nations would also report accurately because eventually all of the nations will all be able to extract more revenue from the fishery.
When would you expect that area to again be commercially viable?
I don't have an answer for that. There are thresholds based on these multilateral agreements where a particular threshold is reached, they'll open up that fishery again. This particular year, there was a lot of interest in whether that fishery would open up, and for a while, some of the meetings that I was able to find out the results of, they thought that was going to open up until some of the new stock assessments had come in relative to that, and the threshold had not been reached, and so they kept it closed. Soon, I hope. I think what I'll do now is to just call your attention to the rest of the book. There's a lot of interesting facts and figures in here. Here, page, which is green, which is our list of the numbers of federally permitted vessels, catcher vessels, catcher processor vessels, motherships. We have a total of almost 1,800 catcher vessels. We have about 234 catcher processor vessels, including all gear types. Among those, we have 52 trawl catcher vessels. And of course, it's the large catcher processor trawl fleet, which is the attention of Greenpeace and other conservation agencies or entities. Motherships, 25 motherships that operate. When we have a figure that shows of less than 60 feet, for example, and they come up with a number of three, probably the vessel isn't really a true operating mothership as we usually envision it, but because of our application system we have, when we check off a box, it might have checked off mothership, but it's really a catcher vessel 99% of the time. So if you get into a figure like 21, which is what we would have called our really large motherships, then that's probably more indicative of what a number of motherships is. Pictures of the fleet itself, trawlers, pot vessels, catcher vessels. And the reason I did this is because for you people who are involved with fisheries, you probably know what these look like. We have somebody that might come here from Iowa. They won't know about this, so we would try to do communicate what kind of vessels we have fishing off Alaska. It's a diverse fleet, and they are big and small. Now, if it's okay with the chairman, I'll jump into issues. So that gets to be more of the meat of my discussion here. I'll pass through some of these issues relatively fast. One of our biggest issues, of course, is the management of threatened and endangered species of marine mammals and seabirds. We have vast stocks of marine mammals, including whales, seals, sea lions, other cetaceans off of Alaska. But one of the most that causes a lot of response in terms of, say, regulations is the Salar sea lion. Of course, you all know what those look like, but I've got a picture in my book about that toward the back. The Salar sea lion is listed as what we call threatened under the Endangered Species Act. There's been a proposal to list the Salar sea lions, at least in part of the range, as being endangered. But right now, that's been a proposal only, and I don't know the future as to how that proposal will turn out, but it has to do with the stocks, which are largely to the western part of Alaska, from the Kenai Peninsula going on west. But as a result, we have major fishery closures around certain key sea lion rookeries, out to 10 miles in some cases, out to 20 miles in other cases, in order to reduce interactions completely between fishermen and Salar sea lions. We don't allow anchoring, we don't allow fishing, or any kind of action in those areas. And there'll be more response to what might be done to try to conserve Salar sea lions and try to reduce the status where sea lions are at. The next item is seabirds. And I've got a couple pictures of endangered seabirds here. One that you might be reading about in the paper is called the short-tailed albatross. This is one where the North Pacific Council recently at its December meeting recommended that we implement certain seabird protection measures in order to prevent the catch of this particular bird by hook and line gear. We have what we call a biological opinion, which is an agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is the managing entity for seabirds off Alaska, where if there were a take of two seabirds, which I mean a mortality, a killing of two short-tailed albatross, then we would actually be authorized to shut down the hook and line fishery off Alaska. And this would be for the groundfish fishery. It would not impact the halibut fishery, but the entire cod, rockfish, sablefish, the entire IFQ fishery for sablefish would get shut down, at least temporarily, if they were to have a mortality of two of these birds. So the industry has responded aggressively on that. They are trying to stay ahead of the curve on this one. There's been a major initiative by these entities operating out of Seattle to try to get ahead of this curve so that their own fishermen recognize that it's a serious business and their opportunity to fish in this hook and line fishery could be actually shut off. So now I'll talk somewhat here on waste and discard.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Can I ask a question on that? Ask a question I really want to ask, but how much money is this fishery worth if it shuts down for what total of 4 albatrosses in 2 years. It's like, what, a $500 million ground fishery? What are the totals here? How much per bird are we talking about here if it shuts down?
Well, I'm not real sure of my figures, but I think we're talking a figure around the $50 million for the sable fish fishery itself. That reaching 4 birds would not shut down the halibut fishery, which is also an extremely lucrative fishery. And there's also value for the cod to the hook and line fishermen off Alaska too. There are facts and figures about these fisheries that I can get in more detail, but for the sablefish fishery, as I recall, it's around $50 million. So I guess you could divide that by 4 and get a value of each bird.
$12,500.
But nonetheless, you know, even though the value of the fishery is large, the federal government, under the Endangered Species Act, is also assessing the value and non-monetary value on our ability to protect a species from going endangered. This particular bird, the short-tailed albatross, there's about 800 in the world, and we don't have a real feel if we were to have 4 birds caught over a 2-year period as to how that might endanger the population. I think what would happen is that there would be a shutdown of the fishery, and then there would be a reconsultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service to determine if there was something different. Why was it that 4 birds might have been caught in 1 year, or say, or over a 2-year period? Or why would two birds be caught in 1 year? Was there something different about the distribution of the birds? Was there something different about the way the fishery was being conducted? Was there something that could be done in order to prevent a further mortality?
I've got a suggestion. Why can't we just raise a few of them things and those things in, you know, in captivity? And, you know, if we can produce 4 birds in captivity, and then that would offset the 4 birds that in 2 years, and then it'd be a net loss of 0. And at $12,500,000 a bird, that'd be pretty cost effective.
It'd be like the no net loss on the wetlands.
Yeah, no net bird loss.
Mitigating measures, sure. I don't know how hard it is to raise a short-tailed albatross. I'm not an ornithologist. This is a bird that's got 11-foot wingspan and probably has particular type of behavioral characteristics. When I look at the vast amounts of money that have been put into, for example, the Condor program, I couldn't answer the question as to about the feasibility of it. But mitigating measures is a factor that is important to the government in all these programs.
You bet. One more?
We're too casual.
Do you happen to know where do they rear their young? Do they have nests on shore or in what areas?
Yeah, as I understand, there's an island off of Japan, which is a major breeding ground for these birds, and they do nest on shore. As I understand it, it's one of these species of birds that returns to a nesting site and therefore lands on ground about once a year, only for the purpose of breeding, and is a seabird for the rest of its life, either in the air or landing on the ocean. But again, I'm not an ornithologist, and there are some real experts that are available for future discussion like that.
Well, I guess, and I'll wrap this up, but I guess my only point is that surely someone can come up with some kind of a common sense method that they could either protect their habitat where they're nesting, or if there's predators or any natural or otherwise human that are preying on the eggs or something, and just get 4 of them and incubate them or whatever. I mean, then you got no net loss. I mean, certainly, I don't know, maybe that makes too much sense for the government to work that way, but you would think if there's that big of a threat, that's going to shut down a huge fishery like that. I mean, I think $50 million is just one fishery. I think I read in the paper there was a $500 million potential fishery that might shut down in addition to this. That puts the price of the bird up, you know, a couple hundred million apiece, you know, so certainly it would be cost-effective to do a little bit of research on that.
There's no doubt that the hook and line industry is staying right on top of this one, and there's been major public relations programs, outreach programs to their own fishermen in order to educate fishermen as to how they might avoid catching even a single bird. There are conservation groups that not just the short-tailed albatross, but seabirds in general, are really starting to focus on marine seabird mortality that occurs in the fisheries off Alaska and worldwide for that matter. And they themselves are very interested in management measures to reduce the mortality of seabirds. We published in the Federal Register just yesterday proposed rulemaking, which is designed to require certain seabird avoidance measures, including measures like fish only at night, tow certain devices behind their boats to try to scare seabirds away, like a scarecrow might work, and also to have the bait when they put a hook out behind the boat is baited, to get that to sink as fast as possible prior to the seabird getting caught on it. Because they know that they're going to have to clean up their own act, and if there's ways where the fishermen themselves can get in there and participate and do things themselves, absent regulation, that they'll probably come out a winner on this.
That's quite a bycatch problem you're solving there. Do you have others that you... other fish species that you might have a similar bycatch solution to? I know that seems to be quite a problem out in that area. And the zero tolerance on the albatrosses seems a little stiff. But
well, let me get into bycatch here now.
Actually, a problem.
Well, if you'd like me to go through these.
Just as you're going through with your thing here. And I didn't mean to interrupt, but I thought maybe that might save some time if you...
Well, yeah, okay. Well, let me jump into bycatch discussions here. A major part of what we do in the Alaska region and work with the North Pacific Council is to regulate bycatch. And it's done because often these species have value, are important in other commercial fisheries or sport fisheries for other fishermen. And then there's just largely a lot of waste in these fisheries that, from the public's point of view, is not acceptable. So when we talk about bycatch or generally waste and discards, it's a major initiative by the federal government to try to resolve. I've got some figures just talking about discards, which is in my outline handout, which is about 6 pages in. It's called 1996 Summary of Groundfish Catch and Discards. And all it shows is the relative contributors, both in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea, to catch and discard. It summarizes it for shoreside processors and for motherships, as well as for catcher processors. And as an example, in the Bering Sea Aleutians, by the shoreside processors, they processed 1996, or they caught 1996, 452,000 metric tons of groundfish, and they discarded 6.3% of that at sea. And there are 0.2 at the plants. As compared to catcher processors that caught around a million tons of groundfish and discarded at sea 18% of it. The North Pacific Council is...
Of course, that makes me jump right out and say, why such a disparity between the I mean, the total discard between that the shoreside catcher boats do and the plant does is only 6.5 compared to what catcher processors, you 18.3. That's a big disparity, 10% difference. Is there a reason why that already exists that way?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the species they're catching. There's very little market for flatfish, for example, in shoreside plants. There's very little market for aqua mackerel by shoreside plants. Some participation, but it's very small compared to catcher processors at sea. Pollock, of course, the majority of the pollock caught off Alaska is by catcher processors. We have what is called the famous inshore-offshore amendments, which have allocated 65% of the pollock to at-sea processors, and the other 35 goes to shoreside. The magnitude of the pollock fishery itself is vast. You know, we had a quota last year of 1.1 million metric tons in the Bering Sea itself. A lot of the fish, by certain elements of the catcher processors, are retained. I mean, we're talking 82% retention, and then say roughly 18% discard. Discards will occur because small size fish may not have a market for it, or they're damaged, or they don't have a market value. And it includes flatfish and aqua mackerel, for which the major fishery is at sea. So there's no, it's kind of an apples and oranges comparison to try to compare, say, efficiencies between shoreside and at sea. The species that are delivered shoreside are just different from those that are participated in by the at sea processors.
Would there be any logic to having a different size fish in different areas? Help me with this just a little bit, but I know that on some fisheries you have to throw back a certain size. Could they be intercepting smaller sizes?
Let me talk about that. In order to catch fewer small size fish, well, the North Pacific Fisher Management Council has recommended, and we're working on regulations to do it. And this would pertain to the Bering Sea and the Aleutian Islands area, as a program where they would require mandatory retention of pollock and cod starting in 1998. And then by the year 2003, 5 years later, the mandatory retention of yellowfin sole and rock sole, which are two of the main species of flatfish, which there's a high discard rate on because of small size fish. What the industry is doing now is responding to that because they don't want to catch fish for which there's not a market for, so if they have to retain it, that's a huge operating cost for them. So for one, they're experimenting with a large size mesh in order to allow small size fish to try to escape through. That's probably one of their best solutions now, is to not catch it to begin with. That's not brought on board the vessel, because if it is, they have to retain it.
How about on that? I'm assuming that all the gear sizes for all these catchers are the same size. I mean, I'm a catcher processor wouldn't have a different gear size than, say, a shoreside or a mothership.
Well, they will in terms of, say, the if we're talking about the size of a trawl, for example. Some of the trawl vessels have sizes of trawls that have openings as big as a football field. For example, in the Surimi pollock fishery that occurs off Alaska by the really large vessels, they have huge pelagic trawls which are designed to catch practically all pollock. When I say that, it's they have a very, very low bycatch of any other species, including cod, any crab, any of the flatfishes on the bottom. And the reason for this is that they have large meshes right behind the rope out in front of the trawl called a foot rope, that are large enough to drive a whole truck through. So pollock will tend to migrate to the back of a trawl into what we call the cod end, which is the sack at the end of a trawl where they're actually caught. But all these other species of fish, like flatfish and crab and so forth, are largely going down through these meshes right in back of the foot rope, and so are not caught. That's a huge trawl. Now, a catcher vessel usually doesn't have enough horsepower to pull a trawl like that through, so it has a much smaller trawl. Now, a catcher vessel might be delivering to a catcher processor or to a mothership or to a shoreside processor. For the most part, those vessels will bring a trawl back on board and either deposits the entire catch into its hold, into what we call a refrigerated seawater tank, an RSW tank, or transport to the processor, or they'll keep the fish right on board the vessel under the deck and bring it to the processor. But they have to have a lot smaller size trawl because they don't have enough horsepower to compete with, say, a large factory trawler.
So a bigger factory catcher processor would possibly catch more bycatch because they have a bigger trawl.
Yeah, that's true, except for the pelagic pollock fishery, where, as I was talking about, these large meshes, they have a very low bycatch retention. They are not part of the problem.
Is there a part of this equation, could it be, and I'm trying to figure out, as Representative Osterman was asking, the difference between the 10% difference in bycatch, could it be that it's just more efficient for the catcher processor not to process a smaller fish and they just throw them overboard? Is that a possibility?
Well, I think what happens is that they all want to catch large-sized fish. I think across all the species, probably the greatest economic revenue is from bigger fish, whether it's pollock or cod or king crab or whatever. Big fish sells more. And except, again, for the pollock surimi fishery, which uses every bit of the fish except for what they call the squeak, which is there's nothing left, they utilize it all. That the other factory trawlers operating for pollock that is not used for surimi, it might be using what they call the head and gut product, H&G, or they might be fishing flatfish, which are on the bottom, or for Pacific cod, which is living on the bottom, that really the larger trawl then will catch more bycatch and so has more waste. That's true.
Thank you.
I've got a few pictorials on a particular component of bycatch. And I only use these because they summarized 1996 of bycatch off Alaska for halibut and for the salmon species and for crab species. And it's really only for your own review later on because there's a lot of detail in here. It happens to be my wrap-up report to the North Pacific Council that I gave in December. And there's a lot of acronyms in there which would be difficult to describe now. But there are mortality caps which are represented by that upper right-hand corner of halibut that are applied to the trawl fishery. And then there are various fishery categories that receive a share of these overall caps. And for example, there are cap apportionments for Pacific cod, for yellowfin sole, for rock sole, and for pollock, and for the rockfishes, and for Greenland turbot. And what we do is we manage each of these target fisheries. When they reach its amount, we shut the fishery off. And to date, we've already shut a lot of fisheries off already this year because they've reached the seasonal allowances of these. I think we did a reasonably good job this past year in managing the trawl overall caps. There was a total of 3,775 halibut metric tons allocated in the Bering Sea. And the industry, The industry managed to keep their mortality down to 3,713. So it was less than the cap. In other words, they didn't run right up to the cap as they have in previous years across the board. But on the other hand, I think we actually did a pretty good job of managing the fisheries to keep it within its cap, too. And we shut off these fisheries. We do it aggressively. I mean, these fishermen know that closures are coming. They have a lot of organizations now to try to talk among themselves to see how, where there are particular hot spots where they might be catching too much halibut or salmon or crab, and they tell each other that. And to some extent, then they'll move out of the area. And we've had some good examples of that this year. Real important to the state of Alaska is the one dealing with the trawl catch of red king crab. Now, we had an overall cap for red king crab last year allocated among the fisheries. And every one of the fisheries actually stayed under its cap. Well, probably the reason is because we implemented a large red king crab closure area in the Bering Sea, working with the state of Alaska, working with the Department of Fish and Game, and as we would receive recommendations from North Pacific Fish and Management Council, we closed a major area in the Bering Sea to all bottom trawling. And compared to 1995, the 1996 catch of red king crab stayed well below its cap. And this year, they're doing even better. This year, we noted that the industry, parts of the industry, noted that the catch of red king crab just south of a particular red king crab closed area, that they were getting too high of a bycatch rate. And they called us up, and they actually had us shut off fisheries earlier. They moved to areas to the southwest in the Bering Sea to stay away from these high bycatches of red king crab. And we were pretty impressed. But it's one of these types of devices where the industry realizes that they themselves are going to lose a lot of money in their directed trawl fisheries if they don't take a lot of action to reduce the catch of red king crab. We have caps for bear dye tenor crab, also important to the state of Alaska. Except for the yellowfin sole fishery, last year none of the other trawl fisheries actually reached their cap. Now this year, we're taking action based on recommendations from the North Pacific Council to reduce the overall caps for bear dye tenor crab. And in fact, we just submitted a fishery management plan back to our headquarters office in Washington, D.C. to reduce those caps further based on recommendations from the North Pacific Council, working with Fish and Game, and working with both segments of the industries, the crab industry, as well as the groundfish trawl industry. The next one that I have is just another one on bear dye tenor crab for another management area. And everything I just said will also apply to that one. I'll talk about a pileo tenor crab here. Prior to 1997, there have been no caps for a pileo in the Bering Sea. The North Pacific Council has recommended now caps for a pileo tenor crab. And we just today have submitted a fishery management plan, which will start a public comment period to establish caps for a pileo crab in the Bering Sea. And a lot of those caps were also negotiated between the crab industry and the trawl groundfish industry to come to a reckoning as to which segment needs to give on this in order to have a coordinated fishery where we hope both industries will come out a winner. As you might be reading about in the papers, of course, stocks of crab, whether it's a red king crab or tenor crab, both species of pileo and beard-eye tenor crab are low levels of abundance, and the industry in the North Pacific Council is aggressively pursuing that. Going into salmon bycatches a little bit, and I see on your list of questions here there was a question about bycatch figures in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. That chart I have summarizes that for Chinook salmon and for the other salmon species. When I say other salmon, I'm really talking about chum salmon. There's really not much of a bycatch problem in the trawl groundfish fisheries except for Chinook salmon and other salmon. But as you can see, I've got both the 1996 and the 1995 numbers in that table. And we do have areas that close. We have salmon caps as well as for the other prohibited species in the Bering Sea that can cause a closure. In 1996, we didn't implement a closure because they didn't reach the caps. I'll go through the Gulf of Alaska briefly here. We also have caps that are very important to participants participating in the Gulf of Alaska. We have an overall 2,000 metric tons of halibut allocated to the trawl fishery in the Gulf of Alaska. We also have a cap of 290 tons for the hook and line fishery for the Gulf of Alaska. We've had increasing success in managing halibut bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska. The Kodiak people aggressively pursue halibut catches in the central regulatory area within the management districts of the Gulf, and they stay right on top. I think there's peer pressure that goes on out there. I think there's a lot of attention paid to bycatch problems in the Gulf of Alaska because they're trying to squeeze every last bit of groundfish catch by the amount of halibut that they have there. And of course, everybody understands that halibut bycatches are managed directly by the North Pacific Management Council, but indirectly by the International Pacific Halibut Commission, because the halibut commission subtracts right off the top from the directed halibut fishery all the bycatch. So whatever they think might be the bycatch, that comes right off the top, and it's only the balance that's allocated to the directed halibut fishery. So there's a lot of attention paid by the ground fishermen to reduce that cap because they know that the other segments of the industry, for example, the halibut industry, will not accept large catches of halibut.
Ron, how much input does the IPHC have when the North Pacific Council sets those caps?
The IPHC is a biological management agency, and their charter restricts their involvement to any type of regulations dealing with the biology of halibut, including any over-harvesting problems, anything having to do with the commercial halibut fishery, which is more directly related to the biology of halibut, including quotas. They shut off the fishery in order to not overrun fisheries of the stocks. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council has direct authority to manage any of the social economic aspects of halibut bycatch in the groundfish fisheries. What often happens is that the staff from the IPHC will coordinate and will provide testimony and provide recommendations to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, but the actual decision is made by the North Pacific Council on socioeconomic matters. And if there's items that directly relate to biology of halibut, then those decision makings are made by the IPHC.
Can I just recap that real quickly then? If I understand you correctly, that the North Pacific Council could set those caps economically at quite a bit of higher rate if they wanted to fight that battle with the economics of the halibut fishermen themselves. And as long as the total take in the Gulf biologically, the IPHC doesn't necessarily step in.
That's correct. I've got one graph which summarizes crab bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska, and it's not very interesting because there's not very much bycatch, but the reason is there's not a lot of crab in the Gulf of Alaska. That's why. For your interest, when I say deep water fishery, the DW, and the shallow water fishery, the SW, those are acronyms and regulations where shallow water fishery means pollock and cod and species of shallow water flatfish. If it's not one of those, then it's a deep water fishery. For example, wreck sole, Dover sole, species which are truly deep water. And again, I have information on the bycatch of salmon, both Chinook and other salmon. And again, those are mostly chum salmon in the Gulf of Alaska, both for 1995 and for 1996.
Is there any explanation? I noticed that both the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska fisheries on the mid-water trough, 1996, there was quite a jump in the amount of salmon that were taken, both Chinook and chums. Whereas it appears as if in the Gulf there's been a decrease in the amount of bycatch.
That's a good question. Chum salmon, particularly, there were vast numbers of chum salmon in the Gulf of Alaska this year, and we were surprised not to see more chum salmon showing up in the Gulf of Alaska trawl catches. That dropped. Chinook salmon, again, it's almost an apples and oranges type of comparison. There are vast returns of Chinook salmon in both areas, of course, but those returning Chinooks, they go up the AYK systems in Bristol Bay, as compared to, say, in the Gulf of Alaska, where they go up Cook Inlet. There are distributional changes which may not repeat from year to year, and they might be prevalent more in one area like the Bering Sea compared to the Gulf of Alaska in any one particular year. And it might just have to do with the oceanographic characteristics in any particular year. It's pretty hard to actually answer a question like that without really relying on some of my research colleagues to try to figure out an answer like that. Okay. Moving on to some of these issues, I'll just briefly touch on overcapitalization.
Before, Mr. Chairman, before we proceed, there was a question that came up, and this is concerning the 95-96 Bering Sea Aleutian Island trawl, the Chinook and other salmon bycatch. I don't know what page this is, about midway.
I've got the page.
And the number of salmon, I believe the midwater pollock, we have the year 1996 with Chinook and other salmon bycatch, and 96, if we're looking at the Chinook 51,000, and the 95 figures is 10,000. What made the bycatch come down? What factors were involved in that?
Well, 1996 was a larger number than 1995 in the midwater pollock fishery. Of course, 1996, the health of Chinook salmon in the Bristol Bay area, the AYK area, was showed that Chinooks had were a lot stronger, the runs were stronger. And in 1995, we know that that they weren't. And I'd like to say that it had to do with the success of returns to the Bristol Bay area. I'd like to be able to say that definitively, but I really can't. Again, I think there are distributional differences. The way that Chinook salmon will cause a management problem with respect to bycatch in any one year. There are some species like halibut and to some extent crab where it's reasonably predicted where there are hot spots where fishermen need to avoid areas because that's the home of these animals at any particular time. But for salmon, there's sometimes just not a trend. We'll find in some years where there's been no salmon problem, relatively anyway. And then in the very next year, without any change in the directed groundfish fishery, it all of a sudden is a big problem. And I'd like to be able to explain exactly why that's at, but I really can't.
Because of the amount of time that we have left, and I do want to close this out by 7 o'clock, I've got several questions in reference to halibut, and I know that some of the other members do too, and I'd like to cover some of the halibut issues before we do the overcapitalization and stuff like this, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. Scott, why don't you go ahead and start? I know you had a couple of questions on okay. Subsistence.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Berg, I've got a copy of this draft regulations on halibut subsistence. I have some, quite frankly, some grave concerns about. Many of the options provide qualifications based on race or location of residency in only native villages in Alaska. And since the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council regs are adopted through the authorities of the Department of Commerce and Halibut Commission, under what authority can the Department of Commerce create a new fishery on racial discrimination?
You know, I believe there's probably some of these types of questions that I may not be very accurate when I talk about them. Generally, of course, the North Pacific Council operating under the authority of the Halibut Act itself, not the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act, but the North Pacific Halibut Act. Under that authority, the IPA, or pardon me, the North Pacific Council, can recommend, and then the Secretary of Commerce promulgate regulations. This whole halibut subsistence issue is one that the Council took up at its recent February meeting, and in fact, I brought their newsletter because it shows the results of what they're intending to do. They're putting out now an options paper, which will turn into an economic and an environmental analysis eventually, which will define, for one, subsistence, will also implement particular options for how subsistence as how it would be managed. And I guess all I can say at this particular time is that they've got sub-options, which would include for eligibility members only of Alaska Native federally recognized tribes. That's one option.
That's sub option A, is that correct?
Pardon me?
Is that sub option A?
Yes, it is.
Okay, or option two.
And sub option B is Alaska rural residents as defined by NILCA and identified in the table Alaska rural places, native groups with subsistence halibut uses, which is a published document. And the other option would be where it would be traditional tribal members and also non-native permanent residents of native villages. So they're taking the issue head on with regard to subsistence, and their authority is under the Halibut Act, not under the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act.
Well, I would suggest that under ANCSA, Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights were extinguished, which is a federal act. You know, under ANILCA, which, of course, the state has some contention with, but this is a federal jurisdiction, that it might be more appropriate to do it under ANILCA to, you know, how rural is defined under ANILCA. It is a federal authority. But I'm concerned about legal gear. It talks about contracting with tribal governments, allowing customary and traditional trade of subsistence caught halibut. In other words, allowing them to sell subsistence halibut, allowing subsistence caught halibut or commercial caught halibut under 32 inches to be kept for subsistence. And I, you know, there's a lot of proposals in here, and I guess my concerns are that you know, the halibut resource is already allocated, and you know, whose quotas would be reduced and how would the fishery be managed. You know, the Bolt decision gave priority to in Washington. It's a little different scenario, but gave priority to natives in Washington, and there was clearly they've not the natives, but as a whole, the resource has been compromised, and so the only people that have much of a fishery left are native people down there, and I think it's a source of great resentment to those who have that I know that live there that have fished and now. So I'm a little worried, you know, about the allocations, and then I have one other quick question after that. If you could, I know it's a long question. If you want me to repeat any of it, I'd be happy to. I guess the question is you know, the main thing is the allocation, you know, and where would it come from, and who would manage it, and how would it be managed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the eventually the federal government would be managing this, the Secretary of Commerce, and therefore the National Marine Fishery Service, based on regulations recommended by the North Pacific Council under the authority of the Halibut Act. I guess all I can say at this time is that what the Council is doing is putting out, or will put out for public comment eventually, an analysis to look through these issues. There's no doubt the types of issues you brought out with regard to allocation and who's going to be the winner with regard to any future regulation, that the process will be open. It'll be based on analysis, and there'll be a massive amount of public testimony, pro and con, I'm sure, on this before it's finally laid to rest. And at this time, I can't predict, the outcome of any of this. I attended, of course, the council's meeting when it was back in February this year, and listened to a lot of the public testimony that was brought forward in front of the council's advisory panel, which is one of its advisory bodies, in order to get input on socioeconomic and any other aspects of the fisheries, and as well as public testimony from the council itself. The council is trying to pick a fairly broad range of alternatives at this time with regard to these alternatives. How they might get narrowed down will be based on a final council vote, you know, based on the public process to as to who wins and who loses.
I think there'll be quite a few losers, and personally, I know I have a great the idea of commercially selling halibut or any other fish that are caught on subsistence doesn't wash very well. I mean, I think most Alaskans would agree that rural residents, especially in economically deprived areas, certainly there's more than enough fish and game to go around, that people that need to eat should be the highest use of the resource. But to catch fish for subsistence and turn around and sell it, I think leaves a bad taste in my mouth, and it isn't fishy taste. Bad. Sorry. Anyway, would the halibut regulations, would they apply to both federal and state waters?
Yes, they would. The convention waters start from the beach, and they go all the way out to 200 miles, as compared to Magaznak waters, which start at 3 miles and go out 200 miles. But under the authority that the IPHC operates under, convention waters start right from the beach. so they'll also involve state waters. With regard to your concerns about the commercial sale, of course, what the council is looking at is this, they title it the barter of subsistence caught halibut, and looking at limited to annual amounts of $200, $400, or $600. But again, those options will be finally explored in analysis and brought forward in front of the council, released to the public for review prior to the council making the final recommendation. And once the council makes a recommendation, it's just that. It's not a, they don't make a decision, because the final decision is the federal government.
Well, on that point, on option six, it just deals with sale of subsistence halibut. To allow the commercial sale of subsistence caught halibut, that's not bartering for, trading for gas for taking out, taking a person out fishing or something like that. And, you know, one of the options is the sale, and the other is prohibiting the sale, commercial sale. Yes. So I would certainly hope that we aren't going to, I mean, where do you draw the line? It's going to, everybody's already fought the IFQ battle, and you got their IFQs all allocated up, and now we're going to allow another commercial fishery in. And you know, we just, that's just what happened in Washington, and I'm worried about what's happening in Washington moving up the coast. And the resources over allocated, and the pie is only so big, and we're cutting 9 pieces out of an 8 piece pie, you know, and then the resource crashes. So
I guess there's 4 sources of halibut usage now. Certainly the commercial setline fishery, the sport rod and reel fishery, which is the non-guided fishery, and then the guided sport fishery, which the council also probably will regulate, as well as then subsistence. So there'll be 4 sources of mortality there that the IPHC will take into account in the biological conservation of halibut. All I can say at this point is that this program is really in its infancy. You know, the council will be doing very rigorous economic analyses, as well as environmental analyses, in order to comply with other applicable laws, we call it, in order to try to make the right decision. What the federal government does, I guess, in the since we sit back and we're the judge finally of recommendations and all this, is that we do what makes sense. And what makes sense might vary among various people, but it'll be based on a very deliberate process, based on analysis as to what impacts actually occur. But it's got a long ways to go before we actually see a program here.
Thanks for that latitude, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to conclude that I'm not...
I've got a couple of questions reference to the halibut. First off, do you know off top what kind of metric tons we're talking about in halibut quotas that are set for, like, the IFQ programs, the commercial fishing end of it?
Well, of course, the entire commercial fishery off Alaska now is allocated to the IFQ program. And
I mean, is that 400 metric tons, or is it 500?
Well, as I recall, I'm trying to see a table in front of my eyes here that's been pretty recent. But as I recall, it was in the order of like 28 million pounds, expressed in pounds, the 1996 IFQ fishery for halibut.
How does that relate to the metric tons of capped in the trawl or the trawl industry? I think one of your reports said there was 3,775 metric tons on the cap on halibut for the trawl industry.
Yeah, we have, let's say roughly, if it was 4,000 tons, well, that's 8 million pounds. So that's a large proportion. It's far less than the commercial fishery, but it's sufficiently large that the IPHC, as well as Canada, the west coast of Canada, takes a strong interest in what actions the groundfish fisheries are doing to reduce that catch. So it is a large proportion. It's not small. And it's a fishery that probably could have a lot more direct value to the sable fish or to the halibut setline fishery if bycatch could be reduced.
If the North Pacific Council decides that they want to allocate the halibut in a different method, for example, you mentioned four areas. Subsistence and commercial and sport fish and then guided fish. If they wanted to allocate economically the portion to a small fisheries or an Alaskan fisheries within the 3 mile limit, for example, I mean that is potentially something that could happen based on the economics of the allocation of those fish.
For example,
if
like community quotas, for example, yeah, they could do that. They have the authority to do that. The existing CDQ program, community development quota in the Bering Sea, that is participated in by 50 specific villages, which are, I think that's the number, that are within the a particular distance from the shoreline. That's one example where they have done that. But they could actually take an area like Kodiak, for example, and they could assign a community quota for halibut. They could go in, for example, out in Sandpoint, in those areas out to the west. What they have to do is do a type of a program that has net benefits for the nation. That's a term of art I talk about when I say that. Under our other applicable laws that we have, we're required to implement regulations that have a summed up net benefit to the nation. Unless some regulation is in the other direction, then or something might be disapproved because of policy reasons, the council could make a recommendation like that. Whether or not it would actually be approved would be dependent on this whole concept about, you know, net benefits of the nation.
I guess the point I'm driving at is that if they were to, if somebody was to make that kind of request and they were to consider it, it wouldn't be something that would be outside of the jurisdiction of the IPHC, because they're basically dealing with the biological. So if the caps, total cap of halibut catch stayed the same, just the distribution of it changed, it would have no effect on that treaty.
That's correct.
Okay. And that's the last one I had on halibut. I want to go back just a second before we go any more halibut stuff, before I forget about it. Your chart on the Bering Sea catch of Chinook salmon and stuff, showing the great jump from 95 to 96, particularly in the midwater pollock fisheries. I don't want any more from you tonight, but I would request that maybe if you have some more information for us on some kind of a breakdown on areas, specific areas in the Bering Sea that these fish were taken, and any information that you may have with backup of what might have caused the jump. I mean, you mentioned a few minutes ago bigger runs and stuff in 96 than 95, and that kind of information, something in writing that I can actually sit down and read rather than, you know, give you a better follow-up. And Representative Ivan, I know we just talked about that a second ago. He's very interested in that because he comes from that area up there particularly. And so if you can send that information to both Representative Ivan and myself, that'd be greatly appreciated.
I can provide information on the